Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Wednesday, February 20th, 2019. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. Can you notice the slight change in timbre in my voice? The quality is a little bit... It's because I'm on vacation, folks. I'm on vacation, and I'm starting to feel it a little bit. But we still have a brand new interview for you today. Alexandra Natapoff, professor of law at the University of California, Irvine, on punishment without crime, how our massive misdemeanor system traps the innocent and makes America more unequal. I did not understand what a misdemeanor was. I thought I did, but I did not before I spoke to the professor.
I got one of those ones.
You had one of those times where you thought you knew something?
No,
you
where I had a misdemeanor.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Really?
Loud party, baby. In Fargo.
Well, let me guess what happened to you. Nothing.
I had to pay like $200.
Right. Well, okay. It is fascinating how problematic our misdemeanor system is. And we talk about criminal justice reform, we hear nothing about it. And it is so disparate, the implications of a misdemeanor from place to place. Highly problematic. Fascinating stuff, Professor Alexandra Natapoff. And if you are a member, you will have the opportunity to hear a deep archive pick from Brendan, our deep archive explorer. We sent him down there, and God knows. You know what he did? He found a carcass of some type of ferret in the vault, and snuff films. That was right next to my old snuff films. But he trudged up a couple of reel-to-reel tapes. We pulled a deep archive from the old Air America days, the old Majority Report. I don't know what it is. Maybe it's the Cowboy Junkies singing live in studio. Maybe it's I don't know. Bill Maher. We interviewed Bill Maher. Or Eddie Vedder. Or Gary Hart. Or Altman in studio. Or, God, I can't believe the people we interviewed in studio and at other places. But anyways, but if you're not a member, folks, I'm sorry. Brendan's trip was not for you. But you can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com for just pennies a day. You get to support your favorite podcast, daily podcast, or second favorite podcast, or third. So I'm not going to, doesn't matter. We're polyamorous here. But go to join the Majority Report. Just costs you literally dimes and nickels a day. We give you the show commercial free, and we give you extra content virtually every day. And you support this program. Which we've been doing now for eight and a half years. In a month, I will be celebrating my 15th year in this business. Yeesh. All right. JoinTheMajorityReport.com. Quick break. When we come back, Alexandra Natapoff And don't forget, over the next 2 or 3 days, we've got tomorrow, we've got a great interview with Catherine Ballou. Then on Friday, an interview that just blew my mind about racism in this country. But for now, Alexandra Natapoff, be right back. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program a 2016 Guggenheim Fellow Award, a professor of law at UC Irvine, and a former public defender from Baltimore, and author of Punishment Without Crime, How Our Massive Misdemeanor System Traps the Innocent and Makes America More Unequal. Alexandra Natapoff, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, so let's start with the question, what is a misdemeanor? Because I've been sitting here wondering have I ever been found guilty of a misdemeanor. In my youth in New York City, I engaged in a various array of activities that I was ticketed for, and I had to have a court appearance for. I think both the cases were dismissed, but I don't know if they were misdemeanors or not. If I have to tell you what they were, I will. But why don't we start with a more general answer?
I won't make you disclose. But as a technical matter, misdemeanor typically refers to a minor offense for which a person can serve no more than 1 year incarceration. That's kind of the generic definition. But on one end of the spectrum, some states have much more serious misdemeanors, 2, 3, 4 year potential sentences. And at the other end of the spectrum, misdemeanors can be extraordinarily minor. They can range from, you know, spitting to jaywalking to loitering. 25 states make speeding a misdemeanor. It's in their criminal, the traffic code is criminalized. So you can see that it's an enormously broad category that sweeps in all kinds of low-level conduct and all kinds of offenses, ranging from the truly minor to the, you know, to the authentically serious DUI and domestic violence offenses of that nature.
I mean, that seems so broad as to almost be meaningless. Like, what does it mean relative? Like, what's a felony, I guess?
Yeah. So you're right that the line between misdemeanor and felony can be fuzzy. It can be fuzzy substantively in the sense that some offenses that one jurisdiction might treat as a felony are treated by other jurisdictions as a misdemeanor. There's no universal sets of definitions. Sometimes we handle low-level felonies in the same kind of quick and dirty, sloppy way that we handle misdemeanors. And conversely, sometimes we treat misdemeanors more seriously. The reason I argue in the book that it is worth thinking of misdemeanors as a meaningful category, thinking of the misdemeanor system as a meaningful public institution, is because there is this enormous low-level world of minor offenses, low-level conduct for which people are typically sentenced in more lenient ways compared to the kinds of long sentences we have now become accustomed to grappling with as part of mass incarceration, and that this low-level world has some distinctive characteristics that are meaningful, even though the lines are blurry. So, for example, the offense, the underlying conduct is often very minor, in the sense of there are no victims. No one is hurt. That, as a sort of conventional matter, we don't think that loitering or trespassing is particularly dangerous or blameworthy. At the same time, the way we process misdemeanors, on average, not everywhere, it's a big country and an enormous system, but on average, we treat misdemeanors differently than we treat serious offenses. We process them more quickly. Many people do not get lawyers. People are under extraordinary pressure to plead guilty just to get the process over with or to get out of jail. And because the system is so enormous, 80% of all state dockets are misdemeanors. This is mostly what our criminal system does. and it affects so many millions of people. 13 million misdemeanor cases are filed every year. I think it's worth zeroing in on this enormous aspect of the criminal system and asking ourselves if this is really a good way to run most of our criminal justice system.
What is the, I mean, I'm still like, you know, like, so to the extent that in terms of the crime, I guess, there it's theoretically victimless, or at least nobody gets hurt. Why do we have this system of, I want to dig into this obviously. And I think like, you know, people can start to see the contours of the implications of such a fuzzy and sort of subjective quality to this, one which seems sort of arbitrary in some respects, at least in terms of like on the punishment side. And we can, I think people can start to see the sort of the broad contours of how this is used as a way of, you know, like what kind of policing we're talking about. But what was ultimately the justification between a felony and a misdemeanor? Like, what was the efficiency that was supposed to be there? Or what was the principle, you know, the judicial principle or just the principle of justice that was involved? In because it just seems to me the spectrum of stuff is so wide. And the idea that you could spend a year in jail for a misdemeanor, which is not something I think I was aware of, that seems pretty serious to me. So what was the what's the theory behind splitting them up between a felony and a misdemeanor?
Yes. Yeah, so let me back up to the early part of your comment where you say that these crimes are victimless. I think it's important to notice to note that they aren't always right. So obviously domestic violence is not a victimless crime.
Right,
it's
right.
Maybe the paradigmatic crime that involves vulnerable victims. DUI, you know, over the decades, we have come to the consensus that even if no one is actually hurt, that driving under the influence can be a threat to public safety. So I just want to emphasize that the range of low-level offenses that jurisdictions typically define as misdemeanors can range from, you know, harmful or crimes that involve victims or crimes that do pose a meaningful or recognizable threat, all the way down to the crimes you're referring to, order maintenance crimes, spitting, loitering, trespassing, disorderly conduct, sort of the crimes that we associate now with these deeply contested questions about fair policing. And to recognize that states, counties, municipalities, each of these jurisdictions can handle those questions differently. So this goes back to your original point of this is so large, can we say meaningful things about the entire system, or how much of a stretch is that? One way to answer or to address that conundrum is to answer your question, which what is the principle between distinguishing between a felony and a misdemeanor? And I think, you know, principle is too strong a word. These are old, old categories, hundreds and hundreds of years old. We borrowed them from the British, as we did, you know, much of our criminal system and common law system. And the eminent historical British commentator, William Blackstone, distinguished them merely as categories of severity. Felonies are serious crimes. Misdemeanors are less serious. Now, that used to mean something different in 17th century England, because a felony, the definition of a felony meant that you could be sentenced to death, whereas a misdemeanor was any lesser offense that did not necessarily, that did not carry capital punishment. And those definitions have morphed over hundreds of years to give us the kind of sprawling, slightly vague, modern treatment of misdemeanors. But the general point is that we think of serious offenses differently than we do minor offenses. And felony and misdemeanor are just labels that we use to roughly capture our intuitions that there's something very different about committing a bank robbery or a murder, a felony, or what they used to call an infamous crime, than a lesser crime, a misdemeanor, something you shouldn't do, or that we want the police to be able to intervene in your life and your liberty in order to stop you from doing, but not necessarily because it carries that infamy, that threat of a felony. As a result of those kind of broad categories, jurisdictions all over the United States handle those questions differently. That's why you get such a broad range of definitions.
I have that sort of broad gist, but it does sort of strike me as being just surprisingly like hodgepodge. Right. I mean, well, we're talking about something that's been so specific, and let's talk about, I guess, what would be arguably the seminal misdemeanor case. Right. And this is that the case of Gail Atwater. Why don't you just tell us that and give us a sense of like what the implications were of that case?
Yeah, I think it is an example that really captures both the hodgepodge quality, or the what I would call the unprincipled quality of the misdemeanor system, that it's become the dumping ground for all kinds of social control, for all kinds of inequitable social regulations that we just let these lower echelons of the criminal system handle for us in kind of a, as you say, a hodgepodge or opaque and sloppy way. So Gail Atwater was a mom of two. She lived in Texas and was pulled over for driving with her children who were not in in seat belts. So it was a seat belt violation. They were driving in their hometown of Lago Vista, Texas, around the local park because her son Mac, who was three at the time, had lost his suction cup toy in the park, and she had told the kids they could take off their seatbelts to look out the window while they were looking in the park for the toy. The officer pulled them over and right there and then told Gail Atwater she's going to jail for the seatbelt violations. He was going to arrest her right then and there. The children are crying. They're petrified. Ms. Atwater asks if she can drop her kids at a neighbor's house, before she's taken to the jail. The officer says, no, everyone's going, they're going to have to come with you. It just turned out that a neighbor passed by and took the kids. So Ms. Atwater was taken to the jail. She was put in a jail cell. She was booked. Her possessions were taken from her. She was fingerprinted, mugshot, the whole nine yards for a seatbelt violation for which she could not have gone to jail. The maximum penalty for the violation that she was arrested for was a $50 fine. It carried no jail term. We would call it a non-jailable misdemeanor. In other words, it's in the criminal code. It's technically a misdemeanor, but you can't go to jail for it.
You can go to jail before you're convicted of it.
Exactly. And so what happened was that Gail Atwater sued the police department. And she argued that because she could not have gone to jail for the seatbelt violation, the police officer should not have been able to jail her incident to the arrest, to effectuate what we call a full-fledged custodial arrest. And the Supreme Court ruled against her.
We should just add, too, right, this is not a situation where, well, she was jailed because she was resisting arrest. There was no subsidiary or secondary.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. It was merely because she committed the seatbelt violation, it triggered the officer's power to take her to jail. And then in a later case, the Supreme Court reaffirmed its decision that this was, the court called it reasonable. It is a reasonable incident of any low-level misdemeanor, even if you can't go to jail for it, that the police can arrest you and take you to jail. In a later case, Albert Florence was arrested, in this case not even for a misdemeanor, for a failure to pay a civil fine. He was taken to jail in New Jersey. He spent 6 days in the jail, shuffling from jail to jail before they before a lawyer showed the court that it was, in fact, a mistake. He had, in fact, paid the fine. During that time, he was strip searched. His genitals were inspected. He had to take a delousing shower, basically the full-fledged intrusive experience that people who are incarcerated in jails often undergo. He likewise argued to the Supreme Court that for his minor offense, for which he could not have been jailed, it was unreasonable to make him undergo all this intrusion. The Supreme Court again ruled against him and held that, like Gail Atwater, if you have committed a low-level offense, then the police can arrest you, and if they can arrest you, they can take you to jail. And if they can take you to jail, they can strip search you. And so the reason these are such important cases is because they open up this enormous net of policing and intrusion and incarceration based on the most minor offenses for which the legislatures in those various jurisdictions have already decided you can't go to jail. But in some sense, that doesn't matter. You can still be incarcerated for those kinds of offenses. So it's a way of understanding just how powerful that net really is.
So if I understand it correctly, I mean, conceptually, it seems like as soon as an officer arrests you, even for regardless of the offense, even if it's an offense that is not jailworthy, it almost as if your identity and the suite of rights that are available to you changes, and therefore they can do anything with it, you know, in terms of like jailing you. Like, you can't just walk up, if you're a cop, you can't just walk up to somebody and say, I'm going to take you to jail, right? Because you have certain rights and you can't be arrested for no reason. I mean, he could take you to jail, but, you know, subsequent to that, you could get some type of redress. But it seems that, like, once you're arrested, regardless for what the underlying crime is, you enter into a new identity under the law that allows you to go through these processes, even if the violation itself does not require as harsh of a penalty. Is that conceptually, do I have that right?
Yes.
That's messed up.
Well, welcome to the world of misdemeanors. And the key to that is your point. The Fourth Amendment, our Constitution, protects us against unreasonable searches and seizures. You're right. A police officer can't just walk up to you because they don't like the look of you, say, I'm taking you to jail. But because of the massive spread of misdemeanor violations, all they need is what we call probable cause, some small amount of evidence that you may have committed any number of extraordinarily minor offenses. Probable cause to believe that you jaywalked. Probable cause to believe that you weren't wearing your seatbelt. Probable cause to believe that you have committed any number of extraordinarily minor offenses, which are easy to show, which translates into enormous police authority to arrest. And arrest is really the beginning. You might say that stop and frisk is the true beginning of the misdemeanor process because that's the beginning of that net. When those stops and frisks translate into arrests, now you have entered, as you say, that you've entered the criminal system, your identity has been altered. And I think that it's clearer in the misdemeanor context how powerful that is. Because if someone is arrested for a bank robbery, we don't get as exercised about the fact that their liberty has been curtailed because there's probable cause to believe that they committed a very serious offense. That's kind of the classic model of criminal justice, that we get a little bit of evidence that you did something. The state can intervene a little bit in your liberty. If they get more evidence, they can intervene more. But that model kind of gets turned upside down in the misdemeanor system because the interventions at the beginning can be more serious than the crime itself, than any punishment you could ever incur for the crime itself. So it's very through the looking glass.
And so once, and you know, forgive me if I'm overusing this metaphor, but once that identity that you have under the law changes, you are then subject, and this is where the really, I guess, pernicious effects of this whole world of misdemeanors starts to kick in. You are then subjected to any number of I guess, fees and fines and curtailments of your liberty, which are highly problematic and also almost like they almost replicate themselves depending on your class status, essentially, right? Like, if I can sort of, it's almost as if it like lowers your immunity to being subject to all sorts of different things that can then be done to you. I mean, and let's start to walk through those, because I think that's the idea of this. And before we start with that, let me just ask one more question, just to get a sense of the scope of this. When we talk about the number of incarcerated in this country, do they include people who are in jail for misdemeanors, including misdemeanors which ultimately they, even if they're found guilty of, require or call for no jail time?
Yes. Yeah, so when we talk about mass incarceration, that's that famous 2.2 million number that made the United States famous for locking up more people than any other country on the planet. That number includes approximately 1.2 people in state and federal prison, mostly state prison, of course, because our criminal system is mostly at the state level, and approximately 750,000 people in jail. But that number, that 750,000 number in jail, understates the effect of jail, because that's just at any given moment. 11 million people pass through jail in this country every year for arrests, for pretrial detention. You can sit in jail for weeks, even months, prior to your case being resolved. So, yes, our mass incarceration numbers do technically include incarceration for misdemeanors, incarcerate. So 60% of people in jail are there pre-trial, meaning they haven't been convicted of anything. They're presumptively innocent. They're being incarcerated while they wait for their cases to be resolved, which is one of the reasons that bail is so important, and our attention to bail, our new attention and recognition of bail, is so important. But it kind of understates the phenomenon, because there's churn. People are churning through jails on a really enormous scale.
So the you know, I guess to put it in terms of like a website, the unique hits are much higher than the concurrent you know, number of people on a stream or on a website at any given time. Over the course of a year, the unique number of people that actually go through there is sounds like three times the size of what we typically note, or maybe even more. All right, so with that many people going through this system, being jailed for some period of time, let's talk about the implications. And, you know, I think largely we can guess who we're talking about, right? I mean, I committed, I don't know if these offenses were misdemeanors or not. I know I got ticketed. I know I had to walk up to in front of a judge. They dismissed the cases. I mean, I guess I'll say one was publicly relieving myself in the city. I was younger, youthful indiscretion. And one was supposedly I was involved in smoking a marijuana cigarette at the time. I imagine that my experience in the criminal justice system, not typical of some others who go through it. And I would imagine part of that is a function of my race, too. But give me and frankly, my social class, what my economic class, what give us a sense of who we're talking about here.
So we have paid shockingly little attention to the role of the misdemeanor system in perpetuating wealth-based and race-based inequality in this country. It's such an with 13 million cases filed every year, 11 million people churning through the jails, this vast net of arrests. This is one of the ways that we permit our government first to disproportionately mark, touch, burden, punish, and disable the less wealthy, the poor, the working, people who can't, for example, pay fines and fees, who can't afford bail, and then people of color. This is the first moment, if you will, when the American criminal system reaches out and disproportionately sweeps in people of color in these cases for very minor or harmless conduct. Again, by contrast with mass incarceration, I think we've all come to learn and understand that mass incarceration is part of American racial inequality. We understand that the criminal system has played a profound role in creating and perpetuating it. But it really begins before mass incarceration, before anyone goes to prison. It's the misdemeanor system that over-polices poor communities of color, that disproportionately stops people of color, particularly African-American men, for loitering, trespassing, jaywalking turns out to be a particular culprit. Order maintenance offenses, of course, marijuana possession, as you reference, is famously enforced disproportionately based on race. And so the misdemeanor system is both responding to social disadvantage, to poverty. A lot of misdemeanors are themselves crimes of poverty. You won't be incarcerated for failure to make bail if you can afford to make bail.
Right.
You won't be incarcerated for failing to pay your fines and fees if you can afford to pay your fines and fees. You will not get a driving on a suspended misdemeanor because your license will not be suspended for failure to pay traffic tickets because you can afford to pay your traffic tickets. So there's all kinds of places in which the misdemeanor system, by its very nature, punishes the poor more harshly. And so two of the central chapters in the book are entitled Money and Race, because I don't think we can really understand our misdemeanor system, and I don't think we can really understand our entire criminal system if we don't recognize and appreciate just how powerful both the forces of wealth and poverty and also race are in shaping the character of the system.
I mean, isn't the story of Ferguson, like, this is largely the story of Ferguson, that we're using the misdemeanor system as a way of basically raising money for municipalities and towns and whatnot, and we're doing it on the backs of, like, the leverage here is actually the poverty of people. That is what is almost like the machine that drives the revenue generation, like the inability for people to pay that initial fine is what actually brings in the money in a way.
So you're right that Ferguson and specifically the report issued by the Department of Justice in 2015 on the Ferguson municipal court system was really a turning point in our understanding of and our conversation about the low-level criminal system, because it brought to the fore something that has been true for many decades, but that we had not focused on nationally. Local advocates in jurisdictions all over the country had been, frankly, pointing this out for years, but we hadn't really focused on it as a national community. Which is that in many of these jurisdictions, and to be fair, not all, not every municipality, not every jurisdiction treats its municipal court as a cash cow, but Ferguson did. Many other jurisdictions did. Ferguson was not an outlier in that sense. It was representative of a certain way of running the criminal system. And in effect, we permit our judicial system to operate as a regressive taxation mechanism. We let the system impose fines and fees on the criminal justice population, which tends to be poor, people of color, and socially disadvantaged, so that the system itself can extract that revenue to run its own operations, again, ironically, in a kind of a vicious circle, in order to sweep in those very same disadvantaged populations. And you're right.
It's the same principle. It's the same principle as like payday lenders, right? Like, we're going to prey on people living in poverty, who are living week to week by paycheck. They are super vulnerable. They have the least options. We're going to put them into a loan with an exorbitant interest rate. We know they can't pay, so that loan is going to get even more expensive for them because they're going to have to take out another loan to pay off their first loan. So they're going to have double the amount of money to pay back. I mean, that seems to be the same sort of like,
yeah,
it's like the same business model, right? And as you talk about that, will you also, like, you keep saying fines and fees. Fines, I think people understand. Oh, you didn't have a seatbelt on. It's going to cost you $30. A lot of people, all right, I'll pay that $30. End of the situation. But if you can't pay that $30, obviously the money starts to rack up because you go to jail. But then tell us about the fees, because I don't know that people are aware of this, but essentially, like, they explain what fees are in this context.
Yeah, so it's an important distinction. Fines, criminal fines, are your punishment, just like jail or probation or community service. It's the thing that the state does to you because you did something wrong. Typically, those fines, the maximum, are set by statute, by the legislature, and judges impose them as part of the punishment for the offense that you committed. Fees are different. Fees are not punishment. They're basically user fees that the system, and more specifically, many, many entities within the system, impose on defendants, on people coming through the system, in order to pay their own way. They are not part of the punishment. They're theoretically incidental to the punishment, but because they're so enormous, they can easily outweigh hundreds, even sometimes thousands of dollars of fees. They can outweigh the original fine, which of course is backwards, because the criminal system, the idea that the criminal system would punish you, but then the system would turn around and levy user fees that were even more punitive and onerous than the original punishment, gets the whole endeavor backwards. And so your point is well taken, which is that the system, and when I say the system, I mean prosecutor offices, I mean public defender offices, I mean courts themselves, sheriff's departments and jails, probation officers, local municipal governments, all these official institutions and entities are each kind of feeding off this revenue stream of fines and fees drawn from these vulnerable populations. And I just want to double down on your point about calling them vulnerable populations. So we know they're vulnerable because they can't pay the fines and fees, which lands them in this vicious cycle. They can't pay, so now they're being imposed late fees. Now they're being incarcerated for failure to pay, not incarcerated for the original offense, but incarcerated merely because they couldn't pay that fine or fee. And so, as you know, many of your listeners probably know, we've started to refer to this phenomenon as the new debtor's prison. In other words, people are being incarcerated only because they are too poor to pay off these financial obligations. And that, in a way, makes them worse than the payday loan arrangement that you described, because whatever the payday loan sharks can do to you, they can't put you in jail. Civil debtor's prison is unconstitutional in every state. From the founding of this country, states have declared that poor people cannot be incarcerated for failure to pay a civil debt. If you don't pay off your credit card debt, the bank can do lots of terrible things to you, but it can't lock you up. But the criminal system can, and so it's kind of laundered this new form of debtor's prison through these criminal fines and fees in ways that we are now you know, really since Ferguson, just starting to appreciate.
Okay, so let's talk about what you suggest in terms of reforming the system, and you talk about a test of the veil of ignorance. Explain that to us, and give us a sense of like what could start to reform this aspect of the system? Because I think in terms of criminal justice reform, you know, it feels like we're three times removed from this, right? Like we hear it only on the federal level, which deals with a small portion of our incarcerated population in this country. But that doesn't even begin to touch the implications of misdemeanors. And certainly with the Justice Department backing off of places like Ferguson, we're even further away from reform. But let's start with that concept of veil of ignorance, and then let's talk about possible reform.
Yeah, so you're right. We haven't begun to think about this. We haven't begun to scratch the surface. Although there are, you know, we could talk in a minute about where there has been movement. There's been movement on the debtor's prison. There's a lot of interesting litigation going on around the country. Of course, in New York, there's been enormous pushback against stop and frisk and some of these low-level offenses. So the bumper sticker version of misdemeanor reform is less. Less is more. That we need to rethink the sprawl, the enormous, thoughtless, in many cases, reach of this net that affects and burdens so many people for such weak reasons. And so there's a famous philosopher named John Rawls, and he argued in one of his treatises that the way to get a just criminal system would be to put everyone behind a veil of ignorance, that you wouldn't know who you would be in life. You wouldn't know if you were going to be rich or poor or black or white. You wouldn't know if you would be under pressure to commit crimes or not, that you wouldn't know. And that exercise, that thought exercise, would be a way for everyone to think, well, then what would be a just system if I didn't know how I personally was going to fare in it? The idea is if we didn't know, or that we all might be subject to it, then we would craft a fair system just to be on the safe side because it might affect us and our families and people we cared about. And the idea here is that the misdemeanor system is so enormous. I mean, 13 million cases every year. This is, you know, it's about as common to get a misdemeanor in this country as it is to go to the doctor when you get the flu. It's not, or attending a four-year college. It's a very common occurrence. And so the idea is really we're all exposed to the misdemeanor system. I mean, as you pointed out, you yourself were exposed to it early in life. And so since we're all going to be exposed to it, that we all have a vested interest in making sure that it's fair and equitable and safe. In a way, I think that people have lost sight of when it comes to more serious offenses. We don't think we're all at risk for being arrested for robbing a bank. And we would be right in thinking that. But we are all at risk of being arrested and processed for a misdemeanor, even though it disproportionately affects the most vulnerable. Anyone can get a misdemeanor. Anyone of any race, class, anyone in any neighborhood. And so the idea is that we should strengthen the integrity of this system and shrink it, because it actually affects all of us in some way, and if not us personally, our kids, our neighbors, people we work with. This is an enormous public policy to which we have paid just really shockingly little attention.
How do we do this? In terms of, I mean, it has to be state by state.
Maybe even city by city. Our criminal system is a profoundly local institution. At any rate, as you pointed out, the federal system, to which we pay an enormous amount of attention, comprises a very small percentage of cases. Less than 5% of criminal cases in this country are federal. A small percentage of people who are incarcerated are actually federal prisoners. It's mostly at the state level. The misdemeanor system occurs at the state level, the county level, even the municipal level, the Ferguson Municipal Court was the city's court. And it is surrounded, Ferguson was surrounded by a dozen other municipalities running their own local courts in much the same extractive, regressive ways. So I think that that is both, you know, both a problem and an opportunity. So on the one hand, the Supreme Court can't fix it. On the other hand, we don't need the Supreme Court to fix it. The kind of reform and change that we have seen in the last, you know, 5 to 6 years on the misdemeanor, stage have largely been local. So just by way of example, a couple years ago, a lawsuit was filed against the Harris County Jail. That's Houston. It's the third largest jail in the country, and the lawsuit argued that the bail practices in that jail were unconstitutional because essentially they violated the Equal Protection Clause. They were locking up poor people merely because they were poor, which is a violation of constitutional law. While that case is still on appeal, it was successful in the early stages. The federal district court in that case declared the system unconstitutional, and over 10,000 people have either been released or avoided jail because of that one lawsuit in one city. Hmm. Changes have been made in Ferguson jurisdictions like Ferguson all over the country because local citizens have worked with or protested to their city councils because lawsuits have been filed. And it can happen in the smallest jurisdictions. Change can be made because it turns out the city council gets to decide those things, or the local prosecutor office gets to decide, for example, whether or not to charge people for diversion programs. That's entirely within the discretion of prosecutor offices. They don't need to do that. And so there's an enormous amount of power sitting there to be exercised by local communities and jurisdictions over local policies. So yes, it's hard to change from above, but it's actually, I think, very hopefully amenable to change and excitingly amenable to change from below.
Alexandra Natapoff, the book is Punishment Without Crime, How Our Massive Misdemeanor System Traps the Innocent and Makes America More Unequal. It's a fascinating look into an area that I think gets very, very little attention in our country. I really appreciate your time today.
Oh, again, thanks so much for having me.